Making Trains Safer, FPL's Future with Solar Power, and Experiencing Movies During the Silent Film Era. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Brightline train started running again a month ago. Since then, there has been a rise in pedestrians or people in cars hit by those trains. What's Brightline doing to make the rail safer? Also, a Miami Herald and Floodlight report shows that FPL drafted a bill that would make it more expensive for homeowners to sell their extra solar energy. We'll talk with Florida Power and Light about their intentions. And finally, the Miami Jewish Film Festival has three silent movie-era films that were believed lost. A local composer gets the chance to score one of those movies, and he joins us. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Brightline trains did not run for 19 months during the pandemic. And now that they're back, taking commuters from West Palm Beach to Fort Lauderdale to downtown Miami, there's been concern over more pedestrian and driver fatalities. 5 deaths in a month, in fact. An ongoing Associated Press analysis of federal data that began in 2019 shows Brightline trains strike someone about every 33,000 miles traveled. Brightline's been trying to get people to hear their public education campaign and has been piloting new trial programs to see if they can help make rail crossings safer. Ben Porritt is the VP of Public Affairs for Brightline. He joins us now. Ben, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis. Happy to be here.
So I got to start with the hard one. According to the AP analysis of Federal Railroad Administration data, Brightline has the worst fatality rate out of the country's 800 railroads. Why do you think that is?
Well, let me first take a step back and just talk about train travel as a mode of transportation. I think one of the things that we should always remember is that travel by train is one of the safest forms of transportation that there is in the country and around the world. Prior to the shutdown, Brightline moved over 2 million people out of their cars and to their destination safely. Getting people off of our roadways across the state of Florida and frankly across the country is one of the safest things that we can do. Now at Brightline, safety is our top priority, and it's one of these things that we talk about, think about, and work on each and every day. We look at safety through the lens of a number of different buckets: engineering, enforcement, education, and technology. And we take on all of those to put on a layered approach of security around the corridor. What we've seen in Florida is not unique to what is being seen around the country. Unfortunately, there's a number of fatalities along railroads across the country, no different than here in South Florida. But it pales in comparison into what people see on roadways each and every year. So we're going to continue to focus on solutions and mitigation measures as well as education. But we still stand by the fact that Brightline as well as high-speed rail is one of the most important and safest forms of transportation in the country.
All right, we haven't seen, any accidents or deaths on a Brightline train. I understand that. I want to look at, but the pedestrians and the people in cars that have been hit. And I'm wondering, is this problem cultural? Are South Floridians just not used to high-speed public transit like this, that we're just that we haven't gotten better at living with it, that we haven't gotten used to it? Is that the issue?
I don't think so. And the only reason that I would say that is because if you look across the country, California has over 200 train fatalities a year. Texas has well north of 60, in between 60 and 100 fatalities a year. And Florida is somewhere into the 40 to 50 range. We rank third in the country because we're the third largest state. And so I think that train fatalities, unfortunately, are not unique to South Florida. It's not that you only see it here. You see it all over the country. These events are tragic. And, we've said that from the beginning with Brightline. We've looked at this. We've researched it. These incidents are tragic. And what is the most tragic part of it is that they are avoidable. The ones that we have seen are all the result of deliberate and unlawful actions to ignore warning signs and the safety barriers that are there to protect us. which is why we need to continue to educate the community that trains are here.
What's Brightline trying to do to understand that part of it and how to deal with that?
Well, there's a few things. I'll give you one startling statistic that has jumped out at us that we're really surprised at. We've placed in one of our new technology pilots, red light cameras at two crossings in North Miami, one at 141st Street and one at 172nd. Those are just designed to show us people's actions around crossing arms that are going down. In just over 4 weeks, we had 600 plus infractions of individuals in cars driving around the gates as they were coming down or as they were down in hopes of beating the train. It's that type of behavior that we're looking at. How do we curb that? How do we educate people to let them know that this is a dangerous behavior? It's not just freight trains that are running on this. And even if it was, Lewis, it doesn't make it okay to drive around the crossing arms to beat the train.
So I mean,
this was a successful technology that was used in Orlando, and it did help curb numbers in that area.
Help me understand how that technology works. What is it doing?
It's no different than a red light camera that you would see at a stoplight. And all it is doing is educating us and law enforcement on how people are behaving around railroad crossings. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is people are not heeding to the warnings. People are driving around the gates, and this is a dangerous and illegal activity.
So it's telling you what they're doing, but how do we stop them from doing that?
Well, fortunately, like over time, our hope is that education as well as other mitigation measures do come into play. Now, I think it's important to take a step back and say that the Federal Railroad Administration sets the standards for railroads across the country, and no different with Brightline. They are the ones who have set the standards for our trains and the crossings at each crossing, each street that we pass. We meet those, and in many cases, we exceed those standards. It's no different than a red light. If people drive through a red light, a dangerous result is likely to occur. Now, what would people do in order to curb people driving through red lights? Well, enforcement is one key, and hopefully offering citations and warnings as a deterrent. But let me tell you a couple different things that we are doing in hopes of changing this. So we, like I said earlier, we look at safety through engineering, enforcement, education, and technology. On the engineering side, we have received a grant that we are about to put into place, which will enhance 48 crossings in the Tri-County area.
How so?
The scope of work is different for each crossing. It includes one or a combination of the following: exit gates, which in case somebody gets stuck in the middle of the track, as the gates begin to go down, there's an exit opportunity as one gate is slower to come down before all cars are off the tracks. There are delineators and striping to provide additional warning that a railroad track is ahead. Centerline delineators. We've actually had people who turn down our railroad tracks thinking that it's a street or a road. So we believe by putting delineators like the orange cones that you see on the express lane will prevent that from happening. And all of these improvements, we think, in combination with others, will enhance the safety around these crossings and prevent people from making poor choices.
And you talk about also enforcement, policing. Do we see, how common are police citations for violating these crossings and trying to drive around the arms?
Extremely common. In fact, in South Florida, law enforcement up and down the Tri-County area where Brightline operates are routinely giving citations for two things: people driving around the gates, but also, just for everybody to know, it's illegal to cross the tracks, to walk along the tracks, to walk next to the tracks. The railroad tracks are private property. And so you're considered a trespasser. You're considered trespassing by doing that. So oftentimes people will receive trespassing citations or a driving citation for going around those gates. That's important. We're constantly engaging with first responders and police departments up and down the corridor on that. We've applied for different grants for local PDs to have additional bodies to enforce some of that activity along the tracks in certain areas. And we've seen success in some of those areas. And so we'll continue to work on that as well. And then we do have new technologies that we're beginning to pilot on the enforcement side that isn't in conjunction with PDs, but certainly we'll share that information with first responders. I'll give you two examples. The first is we are piloting two new types of cameras. One is a drone system that will cover the majority of the Brightline corridor, the 70 miles in which we operate today. Those drones will take pictures that go back to our dispatch center and our operations center to let us know if somebody has left a car on the tracks, if somebody has left a golf cart on the tracks, if somebody is walking around the tracks for long periods of time, which is a sign and an indication that somebody may be on the verge of committing suicide. Those things can be communicated to us and our train operators in hopes of acting prior to getting to those locations. That's one. And then the other is long distance cameras, which allow us to see up to a mile or a mile and a quarter along our corridor to see the same things. Some of the incidents that we've seen, Lewis, are actually unoccupied vehicles that have just been left on the tracks.
Okay.
You know, and that's unfortunate, but it's more unfortunate in that that is a safety hazard for people on our train and for the train in and of itself. If there are unoccupied vehicles on the tracks, that could cause a disaster. And so we want to make sure we're prepared for that. And we're preparing ways to stop that.
And I want to, there are a couple things that you brought up I want to talk about. Just to mention, again, I'm talking with Ben Porat, VP of Public Affairs at Brightline. And again, looking at safety and why there have been five fatalities of pedestrians or people in cars hit by Brightline trains in the past month since services began. There had been no Brightline trains for 19 months because of the pandemic. Ben, you talk about, you know, the issue with suicide. A recent Miami Herald editorial had pointed out that Brightline had said that 75% of the deaths along its tracks were suicides, though a U.S. Department of Transportation study says that suicides account for about 30% of rail fatalities nationwide, and the Federal Railroad Administration's website says only a handful of Brightline fatalities are suicides. Why the discrepancy?
Well, I would disagree with the way that you categorize that. Well, let me point out a couple things. What Brightline has always said is that 75% of our incidents are suicide or drug and alcohol related. So the combination thereof. A couple things. We also take into account different things than the FRA might. We will look at, we will investigate any incident along the Brightline corridor, either longer or in more detail than possibly the FRA. And so we have shown both the Miami Herald as well as the Associated Press instances that were not declared a suicide by the FRA, but that were clear examples of suicide that just weren't deemed or categorized as such.
So you're putting more time into the investigation of each case than the Federal Railroad Administration?
Yeah, correct. I mean, they look at the medical examiner's report. They take it from there. While we continue to review it, we look at cameras, we talk to witnesses. So we do a number of things in preparation of the reports that we put together. But regardless, is what we've always said is that 75% of the fatalities that we have seen are suicide and or drug related. And that's 100% accurate. I think the most important thing is that if you're going to have a discussion about rail safety in this country, it has to be a broader national discussion about suicide. Suicide is one of the leading causes of death in the United States. In fact, one person dies every 11 minutes by suicide. It's the second leading cause of death for people ages 10 through 34. It's one of the top, suicide affects all ages. In fact, prior to the pandemic, the numbers in every single age category was going up. And we've seen that in South Florida, no different. Those were the instances that we see along our corridor. And so it's definitely something that we've looked at both from a education of our own, as well as how can we make social impact in this area? And Brightline has not sat on the sidelines. We've partnered with 211, which is an incredible organization in South Florida, to raise awareness for where people can get help on suicide. We've created our own mobile barbershop and mental health facility called the Buzzbox, which goes to homeless shelters as well as youth centers.
But do you think, I mean, with all these things that you've added, that again, that it's making a difference? If you're seeing, according to your research, that such a high percentage of the deaths by Brightline trains is suicides, or again, people who have been, drinking or doing drugs.
Well, I think that you have to take a layered approach at anything to solve the problem. And so again, that's why we don't just look at it with education in mind or with enforcement in mind. We look at with all of these things in mind. And I do think that over a long period of time with education in the area and a number of these mitigation measures that we're putting in place, I do think that you'll see the numbers go down. We work on this each and every day. And in fact, you might not be aware of this, but the highest number in the last 10 years of train fatalities in the state of Florida was 2017. Prior to Brightline operating, there were 64 train fatalities in the state of Florida.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's hovered at about the same number in the state since 2015 at about the number 44. So this is something that we're looking at and we'll constantly take a layered approach at. But I don't think it's fair to say that the numbers are increasing or skyrocketing. In fact, they've remained steady with the exception of 2017.
I do want to just point out, too, because we're sitting here talking about the issue of suicide, that I'm going to put out, I always do, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is also out there. It's 800-273-8255. Again, 800-273-8255. Ben, look, nobody exists in a vacuum. Brightline does not exist in a vacuum. There are transportation agencies from West Palm Beach to Fort Lauderdale to Miami. How have you been working with them to try to get?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
Yeah, that Brightline, working with the transportation agencies from, Palm Beach County, Broward, Miami-Dade, how are you working with them to try to get a grasp on this issue?
Well, the grant that I talked about earlier that will impact 48 crossings, that is largely and partially funded by the municipalities up and down the corridor. So Brightline and those municipalities offered the matching funds, if you will, from the federal grant. Brightline is, routinely engaged with first responders, municipalities, elected officials, and we're talking about ways in which we can direct people away from crossing the tracks illegally. Just recently during the pandemic, we identified a number of areas in Palm Beach County with different cities like Boynton Beach and Lantana, where we added layered security along the corridor, including fencing and landscaping. This prevents anybody from just running across the tracks for the most convenient area to cross and channels them down to a specific crossing. So there's always those things that we're working on with local governments to make transportation safer.
And that's the local governments also. And because we talk about the legislative session started today, what about state legislature and maybe going to Tallahassee? Is that an option, that could help implement more rail safety measures?
Yeah, these are things that we have looked at in the past. We have approached in the past. We even
All right, Ben, I think I've you cut out on me there. Are you still there? All right. Looks like I have a little technical issue here. My guest, Ben Port, he's the VP of Public Affairs for Brightline. Again, looking at safety and why there have been five fatalities of pedestrians or cars hit by Brightline trains since Brightline started up service again. They went 19 months during the pandemic without service. They started back up a little over a month ago. And you can read more of these reports about this issue on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I'm going to see, is Ben still there? We may have lost, Ben. All right. If we can, we'll try to bring him back for a future conversation, but I do appreciate having him on so that we could talk a little bit about this. And you can always, again, you can share your thoughts on this. You just go to our social media, Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Your thoughts, too, on that idea that I'd asked him earlier about, our culture and why people drive around those warning signs, the warning arms when a train's coming by. Again, just find us at WLRN Sundial. I want to put out one more time, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. All right, we're going to take a break. Still to come, what is the future of solar energy in South Florida, and what role will FPL play in that? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. One of the bills that'll be considered during the legislative session this year, by the way, that, again, as I mentioned, begins today, will be focused on net metering. That's when utility customers who have solar panels sell back some of the energy they make but don't use back to the electrical grid. The Miami Herald and the nonprofit reporting outlet Floodlight recently reported that Florida Power and Light drafted the bill, sent it to lawmakers, and gave a large campaign contribution to those lawmakers as they processed the bill. We're joined now by Chris McGrath, spokesperson for FPL. Chris, I appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Lewis. Great to be here.
Chris, let's start with the controversy. Did FPL's lobbyist John Hawley deliver, as the report showed, a drafted bill to Republican State Senator Jennifer Bradley and the following day make a $10,000 contribution to her campaign?
Well, Lewis, first of all, thank you for having me on, because this is a really important topic that affects the 99.5% of our customers who don't have solar on their roof, but are ultimately paying extra on their electric bill each month to support the 0.5% of customers who do. In terms of the legislation, I would say a couple of things, Lewis. Number one, we fully support this legislation. In fact, we did work directly with lawmakers on this important piece of legislation. It actually predated the legislative session that, as you mentioned, starts today. And it really began in anticipation to a net metering workshop that the Public Service Commission held back in 2020, where this particular subsidy was addressed in great detail, not just for FPL customers, but for other utilities as well.
But when you say that, I mean, you worked with lawmakers. There's working with lawmakers, but again, I'm going by what they reported. The Miami Herald and Floodlight reported that FPL drafted the bill and Senator Hawley basically took what you wrote and went ahead and processed that as the bill. Is that normal?
And I think by that, you mean Senator Bradley.
Bradley, yes, sorry.
Yeah, no, and I think we've been very clear, Lewis, that we work directly with lawmakers. We provided our recommendations. We provided our suggestions as the largest electric utility in the state of Florida that serves 5.6 million customer accounts from Miami to Pensacola. It was a collaborative process. Ultimately, you know, the bill sponsor is a better person to ask exactly what was filed.
But I mean, Chris, did you see it? Did you see the bill? Because I'm wondering if you saw how similar the two are.
I have not. I know that, you know, I know that there are two bills filed, one in the House, one in the Senate, both of which address the issue of net metering and the growing subsidy that's paid for by all of our customers. I can tell you we've worked collaboratively with lawmakers on this issue, and we support the legislation.
Is it, I'm curious, too, also, the money. I mean, the report comes out that the next day FPL sends the senator a $10,000 check. Now, look, the FPL and everybody can send money to different candidates, but is that standard procedure? The next day you send them money?
Well, I would tell you, you know, first and foremost, I think it's important for all of our customers to know that any political contribution that FPL makes is paid for by our shareholders. They are not paid for by customers. All of our political contributions, as I think you know, Lewis, they all comply with all applicable laws and are properly disclosed as required. You know, ultimately, we don't discuss individual political contributions, but I think the senator has made it clear in a number of public statements that she stands behind this piece of legislation, regardless of anyone's contributions to her politically.
But you got to know the optics, Chris, that, you know, you draft a bill, she pushes it forward, and the next day she gets a check.
Optics. Sure. And, you know, I think ultimately it's important for customers to know that we are a highly regulated electric utility that ultimately is impacted by policy decisions that take place, not just at the state level here in Florida, but even locally, even at the federal level in Washington, D.C. So we play an active role in having constructive discussions with our elected representatives on behalf of our customers. I think, you know, part of this, obviously, Lewis, is the political side of this. But, you know, I fear that in diving too deep into it, we're missing the larger issue, which is net metering. 99.5% of our customers don't have solar on their roof, yet they are paying, as of 2021, $30 million extra annually to support the 0.5% of our customers who've chosen to make that private purchase. So that's why we support the legislation.
All right.
And that's why we believe it's an important issue for our customers.
And I want to ask you about net metering. But let me so last week we had floodlight reporter Mario Ruiz on the program. You had spoken to him for the story. We talked about if the bill were to pass, how would it affect homeowners with solar? This is briefly what he said. Part of
so it would essentially make it much more expensive, probably, to have solar panels on your home. That would make sure that you get paid back at a wholesale rate, not a retail rate. It would allow FPL to charge you connection fees and a minimum monthly payment. Basically, right now, it's really cheap to get a solar panel because you can get a no-cost upfront loan. And this would draw out the time that it would take for you to pay that loan back.
Chris, is that true? It's going to make it more expensive for me to put solar on my house?
Well, I would say a couple of things. I think it's first, it's important for folks to know that, you know, the average self-reported cost for a private rooftop solar system is in excess of $30,000. So I guess I would push back a little bit on the reporter's assertion of the cost of solar panels. Ultimately, we're talking about how much all of our customers are paying to support those who choose to put solar panels on their roof. Ultimately, with this legislation, Lewis, net metering would still be intact. You would still be able to sell excess solar energy to FPL. You would continue to be able to put solar panels on your roof. And customers who have already decided to make that private purchase under this legislation would actually be grandfathered in. I think it's also important to recognize that other states across the country have either already reformed net metering rules in their states, or, like in the case of California, they're actively considering it. And I think if you look at the data from states, for example, like Hawaii or even Arizona, that have gone back to their net metering rules, which were set up many years ago to incentivize folks to make an otherwise uneconomic purchase in many respects, post adjustments to their rooftop solar rules in their states, you haven't seen a huge decline in the growth of private rooftop solar installations. In fact, just those two states that I mentioned, the monthly growth rate has declined less than 0.5%. So there's a role for rooftop solar, I think, in the fight against climate change, which we are actively working on our side with all the solar that we're building. This legislation is ultimately aimed at, and why we support it, who's ultimately paying for a private rooftop solar investment? Because today, most of our customers have not made that purchase for whatever reason, a number of reasons, but they're paying for it in their bill.
Well, so basically you're saying that those of us who can't have solar are subsidizing those who do. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct.
Well, what's wrong with that? Sometimes we have to. Sometimes we subsidize things. I don't have kids, yet my taxes subsidize those parents who do. We're paying for schools, but I understand that's an investment, right? Isn't it an investment in the future that's going to be good for the whole community? So aren't we always subsidizing somebody, but because we expect something in return on the back end, right? Is there more solar good?
Well, so I think, you know, when we're talking about investments on behalf of all of us, right, for all of FPL's customers, and I think more broadly the state of Florida, we believe that our customers and the state benefit the most when the largest amount of solar is put onto the grid at the cheapest possible price. And indisputably, it's the solar that we're doing, ground-mounted, large-scale solar. We have 44 solar power plants in operation today, with many, many more on the way as we work to build 30 million solar panels by 2030. Those large-scale plants, Lewis, are more than three times more cost-effective than a private rooftop solar
installation. So is FPL basically pushing more for, you know, you building the solar and having less rooftop solar? You don't want the homeowner to have rooftop as much. You'd rather be having control of it, right?
No, that's not true at all. We have, Lewis, no issue with anybody who chooses to put solar on their roof. In fact, we have a dedicated customer service team at FPL that works exclusively with our rooftop solar customers. We hook them up onto FPL's grid on average in half the amount of time required by the Florida Public Service Commission. I think all of your listeners who are FPL customers are aware that they have an online energy dashboard where they can track their energy use. We developed a special energy dashboard for our net metering rooftop solar customers so they can also track how much energy they're selling to FPL. So we have no problem with folks who want to make that private purchase. This is ultimately about what's fair in terms of who's paying for it. And that's why we support building the larger sites because they benefit all of our customers. It's more cost effective than private rooftop solar, and it allows us to help keep customer bills below the national average, just as they've been for more than a decade.
Has FPL asked his customers how they feel about that? I personally haven't seen a questionnaire yet, but asking the customer, hey, are you okay if you pay this much because we're trying to get more people to put some rooftop solar, even if you never do? I mean, did you ever ask them?
I think generally speaking, Lewis, you know, what we hear from our customers are there are two priorities for customers, reliability and affordability, right? So, you know, job number one for us is making sure we keep the lights on. And, you know, and because of the hard work of our dedicated employees, we've actually been the most reliable electric utility in the state for the last 15 years. And on the other hand, our customers want to make sure the bills are affordable. Our bills have been among the lowest in the state and among the lowest in the country for more than a decade. And we project they're going to stay that way through the middle part of the decade at the very least. The thing with rooftop solar is ultimately for the customers who don't have it on their roof, so 99.5% of our customers, it's actually increasing their bill. So if you think generally speaking about what's important to our customers and what we hear from our customers, reliability and affordability, ultimately, rooftop solar increases the bills for folks who choose not to make that purchase or otherwise can't make that purchase.
Let me finish with this, Chris. And again, you know, we have a link to the Miami Herald and Floodlight Report, but one of the things that FPL did post on its own blog was an attack on the reporter, Mary Ellen Kloss. And I'm wondering, you know, if there was issue with the story, with the reporting, if there were inaccuracies, why FPL didn't just attack the inaccuracies, if there were any, why go after the reporter personally? It got ugly. It was personal. What's the purpose of that?
Sure. You know, I would encourage your listeners, if they haven't already, to go to fpl.com/truthmatters. That's the website, Lewis, that you're referring to. And it lays out our side of the debate. Ultimately, you know, I think our biggest issue with the Miami Herald, and I think listeners should know this, that we submitted a response to what we thought was a biased story from the Miami Herald about this very topic of net metering and rooftop solar. And, you know, without our knowledge, the piece was heavily edited. The piece was heavily edited and it was posted under our signature as if that's what we submitted. And, you know, we understand that newspapers across the state ultimately have decisions to make and they ultimately choose what runs in their paper. But that's not an experience that we've had with other papers across the state where we've submitted our opinion to appear in the opinion section. We have back and forth with newspapers. They push back on us and they ask us to substantiate claims. But in this case, it was a piece that was edited without our knowledge. It was posted to the Miami Herald website. And that's what we took exception with. Again, fpl.com/truthmatters lays all that out.
But you know, Chris, in all fairness, Chris, and you were a reporter before, you know, no organization can publish anything from any agency or government agency or any group or utility or company unless it's been fact-checked. And so they said that there were issues, factual issues, with the piece that you had dropped in that FPL had given them, and they can't publish that. None of us can do that.
Sure, Lewis. Again, I would encourage your listeners to go to the website, fpl.com/truthmatters. It lays out the full debate. We believe what we submitted was factually accurate based on numerous sources of information. But again, I would also stress, Lewis, that there's this debate that obviously we can have, but then there's the real issue of net metering that's ultimately driving up bills for customers who choose not to put solar on their roof. And that's ultimately where all this started. It was a story about net metering. It was a story about this legislation. Obviously, you had interviewed one of the reporters on the story, and we took exception with the story, and obviously with the way that the Herald handled our submission to them, we took exception too as well.
All right, I'm going to leave it at that. Chris McGrath, spokesperson for Florida Power and Light. Chris, I appreciate the time.
Lewis, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And we're going to have links to both so you could see for yourself the story, the reporting that's out there. Yes, it was about net metering, but also the story, too, pointed out certain things that they had gotten through some emails between FPL's lobbyist and a particular lawmaker. Again, we'll share that on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come. Turn things around here, move on to something else. Silent films are making a special return to this year's Miami Jewish Film Festival. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, let's take a trip back about a century ago. If you went to a movie back then, it was probably more than likely a silent film. But it wasn't completely silent. There was music, and it was live. Somewhere near the screen sat a musician or an orchestra that played in rhythm to the action that was playing out on the screen. Well, at the Miami Jewish Film Festival, there are three Yiddish silent films, ones believed lost forever, that have been fully restored and will play as they did a century ago. One of those films is Broken Barriers. It's a story of a Jewish girl who falls in love with a Gentile boy, and her family in the village are totally against the marriage. Local musician Richard Verges is performing the live score, and he joins us now. Richard, great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us. All right, do I have Richard there?
Yep, I'm here. Thanks for having me on.
I love technology.
Yeah, I was muted there, but I'm good now.
Richard, how did you get this opportunity? How did this arrive at your doorstep?
So this whole kind of concept of me film scoring stuff all kind of happened by accident. In a way, I do my own music project, which is kind of ambient, using found sound, pretty abstract kind of stuff. But I felt like it's always kind of lent itself to a cinematic experience. So I initially connected with Igor of the Miami Jewish Film Festival through a live scoring of Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which took place 2 years ago at the Coral Gables Cinema.
Mm. What do you think about this opportunity to basically go back in time and perform a score as a movie's playing?
It's definitely a challenge in many ways, considering I had never seen this film before. Nobody really has ever seen the film before. And also there's never been an actual score to the movie. So it's kind of... It's very open for interpretation in a way. So it's just been, I've just been doing, mainly a lot of research from, other films from that era, as well as other music from that era to kind of inform the score that I'm putting together.
So as you're preparing for it, is it just research? You haven't seen the whole film in its entirety?
I do have a preview of the film. So my process has kind of been, I started... just kind of laying the groundwork for the piece, for the score. So kind of picking out the instrumentation and then also going back and listening to different kinds of Yiddish music from that era. So there's a cantor from that era, 1920s. His name is Mordecai Hirschman. So just kind of picking up on different nuances in the music, different kind of dramatic themes and stuff like that, and then applying it to the film, which I've been just doing run-throughs, a few different times, just kind of trying to make everything fit.
I mean, I've always enjoyed talking to musicians as they create a score for a film, and it's just different processes. But again, you're just going by research, and you're talking about a movie that was produced so long ago. Again, as I mentioned before, the movie's called Broken Barriers. It's a love story. It's a drama. From what you know, though, you know, how is that helping you in how you're determining the way you're going to score this?
So, as I had mentioned, this has been kind of a challenge as, you know, my background with doing film scores has been primarily the horror genre. So I've done Nosferatu, I've done Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. So now this time around, it's, you know, a different feeling in the film. It's a drama, which does lend itself to these kind of minor keys, which you do here in the klezmer scale. So it's some, I'm trying to incorporate some of that traditional Jewish music, but then adding my own touch to it, which is ambient music, which is kind of my forte in music production.
Again, I'm talking with local musician Richard Vergez. He's the founder of Noir Age Publishing. He's going to be performing the live score for the Yiddish silent film Broken Barriers at the Miami Jewish Film Festival. And if you want to be part of the experience, by the way, there are limited seats to these films. You can learn more about it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Richard, take me through. How are you going to be set up? How's everything going to be set up at the showing?
So to add, you know, another layer of challenge to the whole situation, this will be on the rooftop of the Betsy Hotel on South Beach. Mm-hmm. So not only will it be a new experience for everybody seeing this film for the first time, but also experiencing it on a rooftop of this, you know, legendary hotel. So it'll be a very intimate type of performance outdoors. As far as my setup, I've got two synthesizers, and then I play a bowed saw, so an old rusty saw that I've affixed with a contact microphone, as well as a dulcimer and tapes as well. So the foundation of a lot of my process is tape loops, which were essentially the original way of sampling with electronic music. So I'll have some of those on stage as well.
And I'm trying to picture, because, and I've seen on movie sets how you'll have, whether they're doing sound or whether you have, you know, musicians performing, that they're watching the score. I mean, they're watching the film, and I'm wondering how you are figuring in your plans, how you're going to follow along. Does it really matter if you're really totally on sync?
So there's kind of, and one thing I always pay attention to when I watch films is the score versus the sound design. So the sound design is when you know, you see somebody hit a wall, you hear a thud,
right?
Or you hear somebody drink a glass and put it down. So it's going to be kind of a mixture, I'd say, of sound design and the score composition. And in a way, the way that I work is improvisational. So a lot of it will be primarily improvisational. So I'll be reacting to what you see on the screen in real time in the same way that the audience will be watching the film.
Because as you said, there was no real score to this film. And so, I mean, like, because we've seen this now, you know, it's become, you know, kind of popular for people to be able to go and watch a movie and a live orchestra is performing. But since I've seen the movie, whether it's Star Wars or Harry Potter, I know where the music's supposed to be. And I find it fascinating how the orchestra is there exactly as it should be. You kind of have some freedom, though, with this, don't you?
I definitely do, and which is something that I enjoy, which is what I enjoy as well from doing, you know, this kind of improvisational music, is that there is that freedom and there is that, you know, I leave myself open to mistakes and all kinds of human error, you know, that occur. And I think that's what will make it exciting, is the fact that it's something unknown and there's a vulnerability to the whole experience.
I'd read somewhere that, you know, someone had asked you and you saying, well, not being Jewish is going to help you in a way because you're going to bring something different to the musical experience. We got a little bit of cut from that preview that you had discussed to get a sense of, and again, this is the silent film, but we hear some of what you're working on for this score. Let's take a listen. So as this is happening, here's this silent film playing out. I see this young woman, her father comes in the room. He forbids her to be in love with this Gentile boy, and that he has to marry, she has to marry another man that he's decided upon. She says no, she can't, she will not allow herself to not be happy and be in love. Watching silent films is so much fun because so much of the acting, the body language is what really tells the story. But listening to your score as you're telling this story, again, you're bringing a more modern twist to it. This is, I don't know, tell me a little bit more about, you know, your thought process and how you wanted to tell the story through music.
So at least for my personal taste, when I for, you know, music scores or film, is more kind of setting this atmosphere as opposed to you know, trying to narrate the film so much, because I like the visuals really to do a lot of the narration, where I feel that kind of my job in this situation is to kind of create that atmosphere for everything to kind of flow around it and kind of create a mood the same way, you know, you would in a daily situation where there's not music really following you around, but there might be some kind of element that makes you feel a certain thing.
I'd read also that part of your research, you had found some old Yiddish soundtracks on vinyl.
Yes. So I was able to, find some of these old, just music from that era. And I've taken bits and pieces of those. And that's kind of when I had mentioned the thing about the tape loops. So I've made, and you hear a little bit of that in that little excerpt you just played, which will be small snippets from this old Jewish music kind of twisted around and put through echo that you'll hear in there, kind of as this nostalgic element in the score.
Tell me a little bit about what it's like listening to that music, especially on going back to some of that older vinyl too. And I'd imagine this is, I mean, like not the records we spun in the 70s and 80s, but even going back further was a very different style of vinyl.
Yeah, it was primarily on 78s, although they've reissued them through the years, but so they were 78 records, the big thick records. They were 10 inches. And my purpose in actually digging out the original vinyl was just the sound, where you get the dustiness of the vinyl, as opposed to, you know, I could go on YouTube and dig up whatever, you know, Yiddish music from the 1920s, but there was something just a little bit more authentic about finding the record and then playing the record and then sampling the record onto a tape and then playing the tape. So it's a big kind of a process oriented type of thing.
Every time I hear, and it's been a long time, I have to say that, but I remember listening to some of those old vinyls, as you said, the very thick ones, it's like you're going through a time machine into another era. What do you say to people who will go to this film, but they've never had this experience? You know, what do you tell them about the state of mind to be in and what to expect?
Just to be open-minded, especially to, I'm not a trained musician by any sense. I've always played by ear. That's why this was my approach to this film score, was to do the research. So I play off of my experience in listening. So I'd tell people just to, come with an open mind. Don't expect anything, too complex or progressive sounding, because this is kind of, it's more of a simplistic approach, where I want to feel like I'm in the audience with, you know, with the people that are watching the film and who may have a passing, interest in music and kind of opening their minds to different kinds of music.
And if anything, it's a silent film. Just go in and have fun. It's a very different experience for sure. Richard Vergez, he's the founder of Noir Age Publishing. Again, he's performing the live score to the Yiddish silent film Broken Barriers. It's at the Miami Jewish Film Festival. They've got three of them. And again, these were movies that were believed to have been lost forever. And so bringing them back for your experience, again, limited seats for this. So you can learn more about the schedule for the festival. And if they're available, what's still available, go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Richard, thanks so much for sharing, and have a wonderful performance.
Thanks a lot.
And that's our program for this Tuesday, January 11th. Katie Munoz is our lead producer. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. And Jessica Bakeman is our senior news editor. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Don't forget, the theme music to the show is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. If you missed any of the show, you can listen to it again tonight at 8 o'clock in the replay. Or maybe you want to listen whenever you want. It's a podcast, so just look us up on your podcast app. Look up WLRN Sundial. All right, there's no show tomorrow, school board meeting, but we're going to be back Thursday live with more stories, and we'll look into a farm partnership in Palm Beach County. The goal is to help get more fresh food to areas that are food deserts. Plus, we're going to check in on how the first few days of the legislative session are going in Tallahassee. Again, that started today, and you can follow the session throughout during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WLRN, or go to our website, WLRN.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Take care of each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.